Have you been sitting on the fence about signing up for the beta reader matchup, or have you signed up before but haven't yet found your writing soulmates? The next matchup is the last one for the summer, so don't snooze on it. Get matched up with those writing in a similar genre and or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs. Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 1st of June, with the matchup emails going out on the 2nd of June. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and go to the Beta Reader matchup page.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. So I recently grabbed lunch with an acquiring editor from HarperCollins who told me that the number of submissions she's been getting has nearly doubled. And I wasn't surprised at all because every agent and editor I know has been talking about how the volume of submission keeps increasing. So personally, that is a wonderful thing because it's more reading for me, but it also means I have more chances of matching with authors. I consider it a privilege to review queries on Books with Hooks and, of course, in my submissions inbox. But at the same time, I talk to writers who tell me that they wish agents would read more than a few pages because, and I quote, "my story gets better in chapter two." I have to be honest, this kills me. It's like me wanting chocolate chip cookies to have the nutritional value of kale. It's just not realistic. Like it or not, no agent, no acquiring editor is going to stick around to see if a submission gets better. It's not because we're mean, it's because we get dozens and dozens every day. I know it's harsh, but ambitious writers embrace harsh realities. So here it goes. It's your job to make your opening pages irresistible, to make agents crave it, to make agents want to read more. That's why I'm so excited about my upcoming course, Starting It Right, How to Begin Your Story in the Best Place and in the Best Way. I created this course after studying hundreds of books. I've mapped out elements that are present in the beginning of all successful novels and memoirs. And I've designed checklists, actual checklists, that you can use to ensure that your story's beginning is seducing your reader. We'll cover how to write a great first line, different types of beginnings, and how you can choose the best one, the best place to start, and the best way to start. Yes, these are totally different things. When it makes sense to add a prologue and when it doesn't, how to frame your inciting incident in an appealing way, how to balance exposition and mystery, how to include context but not weigh it down with too much backstory, and what to do if your story has more than one POV or timeline. Most of all, I'm going to show you how to make readers want to turn to chapter two. Join me for this multi-day course designed to help you break through the noise. You'll leave with a clear, actionable breakdown of exactly what goes into a terrific beginning. If you've already signed up, come prepared to take lots of notes. We're talking hundreds of slides with real-world examples and specific techniques, plus a super fun surprise that I can't wait to share. I hope to see you there.
Welcome to another episode of Shooting the Shit with literary agents Carly Waters and Cece Lira, where we dissect publishing gossip, discuss book industry trends, and the overall state of the book business. If you've ever wanted to grab a coffee with two literary agents, grab your mug and pull up a chair. Good morning, Cece. How are you?
Good morning. I am a little under the weather, and so apologies in advance to you and to our listeners. If I have to, like, this is not very polite, but I'm just going to say it. If I have to take a break to cough, I'm sorry. If I have to do it, I'll do it, but I'm going to try to rally. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. It's a kids' Scholastic Book Fair this week. So do they have Scholastic Book Fairs in Brazil where they come to the schools and put out the...
Yeah. In the American school, yeah. Yeah,
in the American school,
yeah. It was so cool.
So, I know. Yeah. It's so cute. So I volunteered a little bit this week, watching all the classes come in and watching them pick their books and seeing what they're excited about. And they all want to go spend their money on bookmarks and like pencils. And the teacher's like, your parents asked me to make sure that you buy a book. Mm-hmm. So anyway, lots of cute things, seeing what they're buying, seeing what they're excited about, and just bringing me so much life and joy watching these little readers.
I have the best memories, like seriously, from my childhood. Like it was like Disneyland for me. Oh gosh, all the books and all the like merch too.
Yeah.
Like the merch was also really cool. I've always liked free stuff. I don't know what it is about me. I enjoy that.
Anything related to books.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned this on the show, but my mom was a school librarian. So I, as a kid, would obviously love my own book fair, but I would also go help my mom at her book fairs.
Aww.
And so I would go to her school and help her set up. And anyway, so Scholastic book fair culture runs very deep in my lineage. So yeah, I'm excited for the boys to enjoy it and yeah, kind of be a part of that. So that's what I've been up to volunteering this week. There was also the Ottawa Writers Festival over the weekend. And I'm on the board of the Ottawa Writers Festival now, which is awesome. And so I attended so many events and, you know, it was really great to bring so many authors to town and just like, see everybody excited about books. One of my rants that I wanted to go on today, which segues right into this, is I think sometimes as publishing people, we get really in our little like work business silos. And I've been guilty of this. And I think COVID obviously played into this as well, where we just don't go out and interact with like real readers that much, you know, where it's like we go to conferences often as agents, we are presenting at the conference or we're taking pitches at the conference. And so I just, you know, I think it's so important for everybody in publishing, but especially agents, to like go out and be consumers of events as opposed to just speaking at events.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's just incredibly important. I have a couple of things coming up. Well, number one, I just, you know, as I said, did the Ottawa Writers Festival as a like patron, as a consumer, which was incredible. I wasn't on any panels, which was great. And it's really interesting to see in the audience, like how, again, how people react to things, because oftentimes like on the show, even when we're interviewing guests, we are steering conversations and kind of leading the conversation the way we want to go. But it was so interesting just to be like consuming panels about books and seeing what people laughed at and seeing the questions from the audience and like the ways that people were engaged with the different books. I just thought it was so fascinating and a reminder to me to get out there and consume in a different way.
It's important to be around readers. They're the people we're ultimately selling to. We obviously as agents, we sell to publishers, but at the end of the day, reader behavior dictates so much in our industry. And that sounds great. I know we're doing a conference together this year, but are you doing any more this year? Because I know we're going to When Words Collide in, is it August?
We're doing
August,
When Words
right?
Collide.
I should know when we're going.
August, I want to say
13th. I do know because it's my sister's birthday, August 14th. Yes, I do know this.
Yeah,
yes.
So we'll be there. We've heard from the organizers of the When Words Collide event in Calgary that some of you are flying from very far to come see us. I heard that somebody, one of our listeners in Austria, is coming to Calgary to be at the conference to see us live. So wherever you guys are coming from, we're going to be so excited to see you.
That's
I'm
so
also
cool.
presenting at the Surrey International Writers Conference, which is the one in Vancouver. I've been to this one a number of times. They're really, really wonderful. They had to take last year off, so they're kind of like back on this year, which is great. And they're very lovely. I'm also attending a conference. So this is something where I get emails from the Writers Trust, which is a Canadian organization that funds a lot of prizes and awards and that, things like that. So I always read their newsletter. And at the bottom of the newsletter, they were advertising a conference through Editors Canada. Mm-hmm. But the conference is all about the ways that AI intersects with editing. Mm. And right away I was like, oh, this is really interesting. So I'm going to go. I was like, wow, this seems like something I really need to pay attention to and learn about, just from the perspective of what are editors telling each other? How are editors as an organization thinking about AI? How are they advising, again, the members of their organization to think about AI? And how are the editors on the panels going to be talking about how they work with their clients and authors about AI? So there's some really interesting panels. I'll read you the name of some of the panels. And I mean, I am not paid to advertise this conference at all. I'm just very interested in what they're talking about.
I love that.
One of the talks is called Editorial Ethics in the Age of AI. Really important. Another one, Editorial Self-Defense in the Age of the Cyborg Writer. Another panel just on, you know, how Canadian editors are navigating AI adoption while protecting editorial credibility. Another talk is called Demystifying, you know, Developing Nonfiction Proposals and Query Letters. I think, again, talking about AI and obviously how that's going to be used. Yeah, and then another, a couple of other ones. One is called The Critical Editor's Guide to AI, Judgment Beyond the Hype. So anyway, I'm just really excited to tune into some of these conversations in person. It's in Halifax. And yeah, just kind of, as I said, see how editors are thinking about it, because that funnels so much into how we as agents think about our work, because we obviously sell our books to in-house editors and traditional publishing houses. Anyway, so that's next on my docket.
And it won't hurt that Halifax is such a beautiful place. I love it. I've only been once, but it's so beautiful.
Yeah, I've only been once too. So anyway, so I will be there. If anybody is going to be at the Editors Canada annual conference, I'm excited to be an interloper as an agent at this conference, but they let me in. So I'm going to come listen and hang out. Yeah. And where are you going, Cece? Are there conferences you have this year?
Yeah, so I'm going to Aspen in June. It's right after my birthday on June 21st. Nice. I'm really excited. It's organized by Adrian Brodeur, who is the author of Wild Game and Little Monsters. I am low-key, who am I kidding? High-key, obsessed with Adrian's books. And I've heard wonderful things about the conference. I've had a few people reach out to me since I mentioned I was going to be like, you're going to have the best time. It's super well curated. Like, I'm really excited. I've done quite a few conferences, and not to sound mean, most of them I would not go back.
Yeah.
I would, Surrey, amazing. Surrey is like a top one for me. I loved Hawaii as well, like the Kauai Writers Conference, amazing. But their conferences are like, I would not go back to this. This is poorly organized and not well run and just generally not something that I'm getting any benefit from. I'm still glad I went, because you have to find out, right? Like, you have to put yourself out there. You can't be enjoying every single experience you have, or else you're not stepping outside your comfort zone. But this is all to say that I have heard so many wonderful things about Aspen that I'm really excited, because these are compliments I'm getting from people whose taste and discernment I really trust. So excited about that. And then Surrey in August, obviously with you and Bianca. And I'm not going back to Kauai this year because it is my mom's 70th birthday when the conference is happening. They were lovely. They invited me, but I'm like, I can't make it this year. But yeah, that's my, no, wait, I forgot. I'm also going in September to the LKBF Storytellers Conference in New York. It's in the Scholastic Building, actually, so it's a nice full circle moment. I went last year for a panel where an editor friend of mine was speaking, and then for a networking event. But yeah, I'm going to do that in early September. When is, I don't remember the dates, but it's early September, and I'm really excited. It might actually be, now that I'm thinking about it, 9/11, which is sad, but not the conference sad, the date is sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. So let's talk about like professional development at large. Like, where do you think we get our professional development? Like, as agents, one of the things I know, just backtracking a little bit, I know the AALA, which is the Association of American Literary Agents, is working on some, and they do excellent professional development events,
so
I should say.
Excellent.
But they're working on a course to help kind of, and some teachings to help agents with their professional development. Because a lot of what we do, we learn on the job, it's apprenticeship. You know, again, you learn through years of kind of building the skills. Where do you think that you get professional development from externally?
It's actually a really good question. And part of the challenge with professional development, I think, for agenting is just how spread out everything is. The best, I mean, there's obviously mentorship, which is so important. But in terms of like conferences, I think are a great way. I think it's really important to always bring it back to the reader. We are catering to readers at the end of the day. I also think that like networking opportunities cannot be, like their importance cannot be overstated. I even things like mixers, like panels, like again, the example I just gave, like last year I went to the mixer that the Latinx in Publishing conference was having at the Scholastic headquarters, because I wanted to be around other professionals, and just a lot of them are people I know. I actually saw Eric there, Eric Smith. It was so great. I'm going to see him again this year. Again, I'm really excited. It's things like that, right? Like it's making sure that you're in the room.
Yeah.
When these events are happening. People think of it as networking, which is true. But I think to your point, Carly, like a little bit is also like you're doing two things, you know, you're networking, but you're also learning new ways of agenting. So much of the education we get comes from conversations. We're actually on the same round table. We were at a round table not too long ago, and we were talking about like, how do you know when you found a special book? And it was all these agents and editors talking about like, you know, how do we know when we found something special? And we end up talking about methodology. We end up talking about how you run an auction and, you know, other things. I am also a part of a few agent Slacks, which I really like. You know, it's nice. And again, you've already mentioned it, but I just need to shout out to the AALA. It is such an incredible organization. Like, oh my gosh, their library of resources, if any agents are listening and you're like, I don't know if I should join, you should join. You should join. You 100% should join. It's so worth it. Like, it's so great.
Yeah. The conference that you were talking about where we were at the roundtable together was the People of Publishing Conference, which is put on by the AALA.
Yeah.
And it was great. I totally agree with what you're saying about being in the room where it happens. And it sounds like a bit Hamilton. Silly. Yeah. And it sounds a bit silly, but like there's a reason where, you know, if there's a bunch of agents and say you're at a conference, you know, I'm speaking to professionals at this point, but like say you're at a conference and the agents and editors are going for a drink or going for lunch or, you know, going offsite to do something, like just join, even if it feels a bit awkward to be like, hey, can I come along? Or, hey, I didn't bring a car, but like, can I join you?
Yeah.
Really got to put yourself out there because those like those car rides, those casual drinks, that is where you'll learn so much about the book business that you just can't learn anywhere else because you're learning from the years of experience of all of those people about whatever kind of topical thing is going on. So incredibly important.
Yeah. And something that I really admire, just thinking about like people who have mentored me, and the learning never stops. Mm-hmm. You know, you might be doing something for decades and you still find out new ways to do things. And I think that's really interesting. So it's one of the really fun parts about our job. I get bored easily. And my favorite thing about our job is probably the fact that you can't get bored doing this job. Like it's just impossible. There's so many hats you have to wear and so many different currents you have to navigate. And it's very challenging. Yes. But it's also so rewarding.
Yeah, I know one of the things I'm sure we talked about on the show, but that always comes back to me is like, there isn't this hierarchy of, you know, just like corporate America where it's like, you know, you want to be like the middle manager and then this and then C-suite. And there's just not really like a climbing in that sense in agenting. The climbing is very different. And it's kind of hard to explain the way that the climbing happens. Yeah. But the climbing happens through the networking, through building the client list, through reputation. And it's all more of that social currency.
Yeah.
Obviously. I don't know, just different forms of currency in a way that we don't have that like corporateness to us because agencies are essentially all of them almost, I think, in the grand scheme of things are small to medium sized businesses, right? It's not corporate like that.
Yeah, very few are. I think it also, you know, it's so interesting because I was talking to a class one day and I was showing the different income streams from agents. Mm-hmm. And these were all agents who have been doing it for the same exact amount of time. And I showed, like, obviously anonymized all the data, got permission, but I was showing, this is an agent who has, I don't even remember now. If you were in the class, you remember. But let's just say 30 deals and they had made X amount of money from advances specifically. This was just like their commission on advances. And for purposes of the data, everyone had the same split or else there would be too many variables. And then there was this other agent who had like a third of the deals, but had so much, a much higher number, like money number, because their deals were so much bigger. So it's one of those things where, like to your point about climbing the ladder, there's also not, it's not like a situation where everyone has been doing this for 3 years or 10 years or 50, like they have the same experience. No, it's also not the same situation where you can look at metrics that are sometimes external and you can be like, oh, this person is more successful or less successful. Not that success is measured in money only, of course not. But you would think that more deals, more money. You would think that, like, you know, if you don't know the industry, and it is 100% not the case at all.
Yeah. And that's what makes this job like so complicated, so fun. Yep. As you said, never a dull moment.
Never boring. Never boring.
And that's why people do this for so long. Like I was thinking about this. I feel like it is one of those things that like is a calling, is a career in a way where, I don't know, there's not really any stepping away from it really. Like it just becomes part of you, who you are and how you think about the world. And I like, we are salespeople also at the end of the day, right? And as you were saying, like how do we quantify success? Well, one of the reasons we do put a number on it is because we are salespeople. That is our job. Essentially, we're managers, but we're salespeople.
100%. I also really encourage writers. If you're a writer, if you're a smart writer anyway, you are also a voracious reader. And I am always encouraging writers to think of their craft and of their place in the industry from the reader's vantage point, but as a business. So it was actually an acquiring editor who once told me this, and I very much agree. I asked them, you know, what do you wish querying writers knew? And she answered, I wish they knew that they reject way more than I do. And I remember being like, huh? And she was like, well, they're readers. And they, when they go into a bookstore, they are buying a book, two books. Maybe you're like a very voracious reader and you're buying 10 books. But look at all the books that are inside that bookstore. Like, you are rejecting all those books. That's essentially what you're doing as a consumer, as a reader. And I wish they understood that, because the behavior that you see from acquiring editors, from agents, from publicists, oftentimes can be traced down or traced up, depending on what kind of chart you're working with, to reader behavior. Not to say that there aren't systemic issues in publishing that need to be addressed, because absolutely there are, but it really helps to think of how you as a reader, you are rejecting books left and right, because there are just millions of books published every year. Not that many are being bought, let's just be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All good points. I'm trying to figure out where we should dovetail next, because I feel like both things we have to chat about really connect really well. One thing I did want to bring up before we go into some of our long form things is we did see the publishers suing Meta and Mark Zuckerberg lawsuit. So in case anybody hasn't heard about it, I just wanted to bring everybody up to speed about it. But essentially, five major publishers, Hachette, Macmillan, McGraw-Hill, Elsevier, and Cengage, and the best-selling novelist, Scott Turow, have filed a class action copyright infringement lawsuit against Meta and its founder and chief executive, Mark Zuckerberg. The complaint, which was filed on Tuesday morning, which for you guys will have been last week in the Southern District of New York, accuses Meta and Zuckerberg of illegally using millions of copyrighted works to train their artificial intelligence program, Llama, and removing copyright notices and other copyright management information from those works. The lawsuit asserts that Meta's engineers relied on pirated books and journal articles to train the program by downloading unlicensed copies through websites like Anna's Archive, an open source engine for piracy sites, including LibGen and Sci-Hub. The suit also claims that Zuckerberg himself personally authorized and actively encouraged the infringement. Representatives from Meta did not immediately respond to a request for comment from the New York Times. So just some publishing news. I mean, no surprises whatsoever, I think. Yeah. Obviously, really glad this is happening and publishers are fighting back, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we'll definitely see what happens. It'll be really interesting now that there's the Anthropic precedent.
Absolutely. Okay, first we're going to hear from our sponsors, and then we're going to talk about the power of fit between an agent and their client. We have some listener questions and a lot more good stuff ahead. So stay with us. Travel season is almost here. I've got my packing list and I'm ready to go. We just got back from a family weekend trip to Quebec to work on our French. Up next, a summer trip to Germany to introduce the kids to the Alps and hear a new language. Plus, our 10th anniversary trip to Italy later this year. I love hearing my Italian husband speak Italian. If you have travel coming up, join me in using Rosetta Stone to learn some local languages. There's something about summer that just feels like travel. Shake off the winter and get ready to move. Learning a new language is the perfect way to channel that momentum into a skill that opens up the world. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive methods help you naturally absorb your new language without memorizing random vocabulary lists or relying on translations. Instead, you learn by connecting words, visuals, and meaning in context, the way language is meant to be learned. Working in the publishing business means my days are often packed with meetings and manuscripts, but I love how simple these lessons are to fit into my schedule. Whether I have 5 minutes between emails or an hour on the weekend, I can access my lessons from my desktop or the mobile app. Since we're heading to Italy, I've been using my true accent, which gives me real-time feedback on my pronunciation so I can sound more natural when we're visiting local vineyards. It's like having a personal coach to help me communicate with confidence. Rosetta Stone offers 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, and Japanese, so you can find one that fits your next big adventure. Ready to start learning a new language this summer? Visit rosettastone.com/today to explore Rosetta Stone and choose the language that's right for you. Go to rosettastone.com/today now and begin your language learning journey. Between school drop-offs, hitting the gym, and diving into client calls, I don't have the mental bandwidth for a wardrobe crisis. I need pieces that feel effortless and comfortable but still look sharp. Quince has been my go-to for that, especially now as I'm counting down the days until the summer finally hits. Their elevated fabrics make me feel put together without any overthinking. It's that rare combo when I know I look good, whether I'm chasing around my kids or sitting down for a meeting. Right now, I'm in the thick of balancing client work and triathlon training sessions, so my spring wardrobe has to do double duty. Quince makes that transition really easy with pieces that feel as good as they look. They're using high-end quality, 100% European linen, organic cotton, and ultra-soft denim, which is exactly what what I need when I want to look sharp without feeling restricted. I'm a huge fan of wear on repeat items, and Quince's linen collection is the gold standard for that. Their lightweight pants, dresses, and tops just start at $30. They're breathable and effortless, which is a lifesaver. Whether I'm recording an episode, headed to the gym, or just keeping up with my kids, it's an instant outfit that makes it getting out the door so much easier. If you're like me and appreciate a smart financial move, you're going to love their model because everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar luxury brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're actually paying for the quality and craftsmanship rather than a brand markup. It's a high-end style that actually makes sense for a busy budget. I'm so eager for the weather to warm up so I can get my linen shorts on. Machine washable linen I can wear every day. Sign me up. I bought them in black, so they'll look classy with a black slide sandal, or I can pop on some running shoes and chase after the kids to the park. And the price, I had to double check because I was shocked at how affordable they are. I can't wait to wear my black linen shorts. Refresh your everyday with luxury you'll actually use. Head to quince.com/tisnotya for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/tisnotya for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/tisnotya. All right, welcome back, everybody. One thing that came across our desk that we wanted to chat about, and talking about professional development, this is where I was like, oh, what should we dovetail next? There is a book that came out this past spring called Middlemen, Literary Agents in the Making of American Fiction. And as a literary agent, I'm not usually inclined to, you know, read other books or necessarily other resources about the job that I already do. But I do have a copy of this book. Laura sent it to us and I will read it. But I want to focus on the LA Review of Books about this book that Laura wrote. And I'll obviously link to this for you guys in the show notes. You can check it out too, because there's a lot of interesting themes kind of coming up. And one of the things I think is really interesting, because the review is called The Power of Fit. And I think we talk about fit all the time, you know, this isn't a fit, or this isn't a fit for my list, or, you know, da 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 da. And so here's a quote from the LA Review of Books. The work of agenting, falling for a manuscript, pitching it best you can, and struggling to sell it comes into sharpest focus in her discussion of agents who represent authors of color, because they demonstrate that the literary agent's most valuable quality is often persistence. Few agents have the power of Wiley or Sterling Lord to single-handedly make a career. The pressure on the rest of them are considerable. 15% commission does not go far, especially when the portion of it goes to agency overheads and a steady stream of deals matter as much as large advances, which is exactly what Cece was just talking about. This incentivizes agents to hedge, building lists that balance literary and commercial writers. And I think, you know, and we can kind of get into how fit plays into that, how being generalists, you know, play into that, and how much do agents hedge against all of this, knowing how hard it is. Cece, was there anything that stood out to you there?
Yeah, I think the idea of a fit being something that's so integral to our jobs and our industry. I think that authors, I think writers actually who are listening might be like, I don't want to hear that word anymore. You know, I wonder if it's like a triggering word almost. Like, not a good fit. It's not a good fit. Like, it's not a good fit could be the title of every queering writer's memoir. At least, you know, a memoir that will talk about a specific moment in their lives. And I get it. Like, I understand that it might be frustrating. At least I imagine it is. At the same time, this is one of the things that makes our job so interesting and yet difficult to explain, which is, how do you explain when something isn't a good fit? Mm-hmm. Because so much of it comes down to taste, it is really hard to reverse engineer why something wasn't to your taste. The analogy I use a lot is cooking. And, you know, I use chocolate chip cookies because it's me. If I take a bite of a chocolate chip cookies, and please imagine that in this scenario, I have 50 chocolate chip cookies in front of me. It's a happy day. And I take a bite out of one, and it doesn't please my taste buds. I'm not saying it's a bad cookie necessarily. You know, I have eaten enough cookies to be like, this is a good cookie. There are people who are going to want this, but it's not for me. How do you explain that? You know, because we're not the chefs. So we can't say it's not for me because you didn't use enough sea salt, or it's not for me because you didn't melt the butter, or it's not for me because of the flour you use. Like, first of all, I don't know your method because I haven't seen the recipe, but also not our jobs, right? Not our jobs, not our expertise. Sometimes, because of how many cookies I've had, sometimes I can absolutely have an inkling as to why something isn't a good fit for me. Sometimes I know. Like, I actually passed on a manuscript not that long ago where I asked for the full and I was really enjoying it, and then I realized it wasn't for me. And I had feedback to offer to the writer. And I made very clear, I was like, I'm going to give you feedback, which is rare. I rarely do this. And I'm like, you should not listen to this feedback if it doesn't resonate with you. Like, read it, but you are talented. You're going to find a right agent. And the issue for me was that there was a romance between, you know, two characters, and there was absolutely no tension in their will they or won't they. Like, it was very clear that they were meant to be. And it wasn't a romance book. So this is not something that would necessarily be a problem for a lot of people. Like, for me, though, it was. Like, I needed that tension there. And I had figured out, after thinking about it for a long time, why that book wasn't for me. Which is a long way of saying, deciding, it's not even deciding. I want to say that again. Figuring out if something's a fit or not is not a decision. It's recognition. It's knowing yourself. But it's not an analytical process. I don't know anyone who does it as an analytical process. And I am a deeply analytical person.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I made a few notes because, I mean, again, I need to dive into this book more. But one of the things this makes me think about is, like, what is my job? You know, I just said my job is a salesperson. I also think my job is an advocate, an advocacy. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why I do the show and want to teach and obviously, you know, spread the good word about, you know, how agents can help their authors through just how difficult the book business is. So I think about, yeah, like, what is my job? And fit is a big part of it. It is inherent. You know, we can't put a spreadsheet over top of it and help us, you know, spit out, oh, if you represent this many fiction authors, this many nonfiction I can't put things into a spreadsheet and have it say, I represent this many fiction authors and this many nonfiction authors, spit out to me the answer of what I should represent next. Like, there is no Excel version of how to do my job. My job is very much fluid, and my taste and my fit, you know, depends on so many other things that's going on in the marketplace or going on my own list or going on in my own life. You know, how much can I take on? I also think about time. Sometimes fit also has to do with time. Something could be a good fit and I don't have enough time. That's something that also that I think about, you know, based on different periods of my life or my career, like what I can take on and what load I can take on. I think about that a lot. And as I kind of mentioned, as I was segueing into the conversation, I think, you know, being a generalist and hedging, you know, working on so many different categories is also a way to encourage fit, because if I'm a generalist, there's more opportunity for fit. Because if I'm only working on one category, let's say I'm a romance agent or a nonfiction agent, you have to fit into a more narrow box of what is my fit. But as a generalist, because I work on fiction and nonfiction across so many categories, I do think there's more opportunities for something to be a fit because I have more room to find the right author in the various categories for me to champion. And again, come back to advocacy.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, I love that you said that. Fully agree that we're advocates. We just wear too many hats. I have my Grinch hat here. Maybe we should all get lots of hats. I always have it near me because you never know when I'm going to go on a Grinch rant.
We never know.
I think, too, the really interesting thing about fit for our jobs is that it is one of an agent's biggest strength is knowing when something is a fit for you. And that comes down to trusting your gut, to knowing the market, to really being familiar with your taste and the market's taste. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there's a second part of fit, you know, whether something's a good fit or not, which is we need to know which editors are going to read a manuscript or a proposal and say, this is a good fit. So we are in the business of figuring out our own fit, but also being able to correctly predict a fit between the author and that editor. And it is the author as well, and not just the project. Because when we have calls, we're not just looking at the quality of the manuscript, although that is so important, but we're also looking at, you know, the person behind that manuscript, which is also a part of fit. So we're in the business of fit. And I'm wondering whether the fact that the word fit has so many meanings, including mental health meanings, but also exercise meanings. There's a metaphor there waiting to be untangled, in the words of Ruman Alam.
Absolutely. And also fit, I was just thinking about that, like all the different meanings of fit, right? Because it's also like fit in a box, but also like fit on, like how does it fit on me?
It's true.
There's a lot of play on words there. I'm coming back to something else that you said there's a power in knowing when something's a fit. I actually think the power is when you know that something is not a fit. Because we get, coming back to how much we're pitched and how much we get, we have to say know so many times. Yeah, and sometimes 100%. When you see so much, you're like, well, should I have said yes to this? Or, you know, oh, I haven't seen anything that's really connecting with me. But you have to say no so much, and you have to get so comfortable with saying no, because if you don't leave yourself the opportunity, again, thinking about like spaciousness, you have to leave room for fit. And so I think the power is in saying no and saying, I know when something is not a fit. Because I think that when something is a fit is often that magical thing. It's all, you know, sometimes we can't put a word on why something is a fit because it just feels right. And that's why it's so like, we always talk about like alchemy and all of these magical things about books.
Yeah, we're using mystical words. I think this is one of the reasons why I love chatting with you, because we're in such different moments in our career. I haven't reached the point where I don't have time. Like time is a very valuable resource I do have. So I've also never experienced a doubt about whether something is a fit or not. Like I know instantly, beyond any reasonable doubt, the only time that I've struggled is when I love the project, but it's the author I can't see myself working on, which has only happened like twice ever in my life. And that was the part where it's not that I doubted myself, but I was like, no, I'm going to have to say no to this. And I really love the project, but I'm not a good fit with the author. But yeah, I think you're right that knowing when something isn't a fit is the superpower. I just think that maybe for an agent who has more room on their list, that kind of, like, you don't necessarily have to make room for the future yeses as much because you have more room. Does that make sense? Am I making sense?
It makes
Am I hopped up on cold meds and I'm not making sense anymore?
No, I think that you made an excellent point about we're at different points and we're going to come at it from a different lens. And I think that's super important. I also just want, I can't give up on this, but this, like, this idea of like fit, right? And how we know when something is a fit. Yeah. Often the answer is just passion. Like there's like, and
oh,
we
yeah, it's
often,
100%
like
passion.
Anything in our life, we'll just find time for the thing that lights us up. And so it's really just a matter about igniting that passion, igniting something in an agent where they feel like, I will make room for that. I will make time for that, whether it's a busy list or not as busy list.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes.
See, this is why our jobs are like dream jobs. Whenever someone reaches out to me, this happens a lot because I'm an alum of Boston University and we have like a Terrier's whatever. It's like this platform where alums can connect with each other. So I get a lot of messages from people saying like, hey, Cece, I'm thinking of breaking into publishing. Can you have an informational interview? And I try to always say yes. Whenever I'm talking to people about the job, because I very much believe in like, I'm going to give it to you straight. You are not going to be one of those people who a couple of years into agenting will say the sentence, no one told me that, insert.
Yeah.
Someone will have told you. So I'm like very direct about all the things. But then when I get to the good stuff, I always start with the bad stuff. I'm like, but you have to understand, it's the best job. Think of the most passionate moments of your life. Like think of the things that you adore, the things that consume you, the things that light you up, that you get to do that all day long, like all day long. It's the best feeling ever. And you get to do that fighting for, and fighting might be an unfair verb, but sometimes it applies. You get to do that while advocating for the creator, you know, the person who is coming in with the product, but also the person who is unfairly treated in the oligopsony that is publishing. So it's, it feels good and you're doing good, which is like goals, you know, career goals. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And just kind of taking that one step further, I've been thinking about this because I have my panel next week about with my client, Mai, through the Auto Writers Festival. We were talking about what makes a good book club book. So, and I've been kind of thinking about why I feel so strongly about working on book club books and commercial fiction. And for me, it's not about the fact that maybe commercial fiction moves more copies and therefore is more profitable, let's say. But it's also, it's more about knowing that I'm working on books that will be read by so many people. Like it is
the reach.
So affirming, the reach. It is so affirming to me that I've worked on multiple books that have sold over a million copies in the English language alone. Knowing that that many people have interacted with art that I helped bring into the world is mind-blowing and feels like so special to me. And that's the reason why I'm like, okay, I had a hand in making this go from a Word document to a book to millions of people. Like it blows my mind. And I know other people who might work in other entertainment industries, they're like, a million isn't that many people. And publishing a million is a lot of people. And I'm just very thankful that my work has led to the art that I'm connected with to reach so many people. It's really special.
Oh yeah. Absolutely. I love that. Well said.
All right. We have a listener question. I feel like we could talk about that forever. Okay. A listener question, which dovetails into some AI stuff. And again, we need the, I don't know if we need the Grinch hat. We need some shot glasses. Like, here we go. We've already talked about AI once, but here's our AI for the week. So I'm going to, again, link to this in the show notes, but I have a guide. Cece, I don't know if you saw this. The Gotham Ghostwriters put together this really great AI reference guide. And it is for kind of like ghostwriters or collaborators or co-writers. But I think the whole document is great because it really outlines, it's attempting to outline use cases and some guidelines for how somebody would think about AI and their work. So I will link to this because I think it's incredible advice. Disclaimer, this is not legal advice. I am not, you know, condoning this as legal advice. I'm just saying, I know there's a lot of people out there looking for guidelines. And so you guys can find that in the show notes. Okay. But back to the question that we got. Hello, T-Snot-Ya team. I'm a paid subscriber to Substack, devour your podcast. So appreciative of all your wisdom. Emerging author, still revising my first book. Also thinking about query letters. My question for you involves your last few episodes where you've discussed how agents are using AI to read query letters / submissions. I strongly agree with Carly that agents do not have the author's implicit permission to enter their writing into these LLM AI platforms. It's got me thinking that I'd like to include a disclaimer at the end of my queries to agents, something along the lines of, if you use AI, then thanks, but no thanks, / you do not have my consent, end quote. Not only would this create a healthy boundary, which hopefully protects my work, but I feel it demonstrates that I'm seeking an equal partnership with an agent and I won't do anything for representation. I love your thoughts on this idea, pros and cons, and or how to set this boundary without offending agents / editors. Just before we get into Cece's thoughts on this, I actually made a reel about this. I think it was last week or a couple weeks ago because somebody put in. You didn't see it about.
No.
Somebody had wrote in their query letter, you know, they had like a list of things and at the end in their author bio. And then they said something like, you know, did I use AI ? Like F no. Anyway, I made a reel about it. So, and for some people in the comments, they were like, yeah, like get them. And then some people in the comments were like, that works for some people's voice. That doesn't work for other people's voice.
Oh yeah.
You know, how do you suggest any of these things in a business letter? So Cece, I have a lot of strong thoughts about this, but I'd love to get your thoughts first.
I love that the listener's thinking about ways to set healthy boundaries in a way that's respectful. I don't see any harm in adding a line in the author bio that says that AI was not used to generate any part of this manuscript and that the author does not and will not authorize use of AI in our book at the production stage or any other stage. I don't see a harm in that. I very much think that the risk will still be there whether you put that line or not, because it's really hard to control. I very much agree. I'm a firm believer that agents, but it's not just agents, no one has the right to feed your work into LLM or any other type of AI system. I actually saw a post about a beta reader who did that, shared that with the author. It was like, oh yeah, I asked AI what it thought about your manuscript or something like that. And the writer was rightfully so horrified. So what I'm saying is, and I don't mean to be a pessimist, but I think it's important to be like real about, you know, the risks. There's no harm in doing it. I'm not sure how far of a protection that's actually going to get you in practice. I think it might be more, the benefit might be more like signaling your stance on AI, which is good, is beneficial. But at the end of the day, especially given how our entire world is run by like five dudes, and every platform has all these weird opt-in, opt-out things that we don't even know about. Like, think about all the software we rely on as agents and as publishing professionals. There's the server, and a lot of people use Gmail as a server. And there's a whole bunch of talks about like whether Gemini is activated or not and what Gemini is doing with your work. There's Microsoft Word and all the other Microsoft products. It's actually going to be really hard to create protections around your work, which is why, coming back to what we were saying before, lawsuits that hopefully dial up the pain that companies have to experience when they do engage in copyright infringement. Those might help down the line. But again, I feel like I was just like a pessimist towards that answer and I didn't mean to. I think it's a good idea. I just think it's important to be realistic about what that's actually going to get you.
I think that was a perfect answer. Okay, I don't have to get on my high horse about it because CC did it exactly what we need to do. I agree. I don't think it's a bad idea. Tone is very important. And then just realistic expectations about what you are trying to accomplish with that line. In some ways, I think it shows that you are plugged into what's going on. Mm-hmm. It opens up a dialogue for the agent to ask, hey, so this shows me that you didn't write your work with AI. That's great. You know, here's, you know, it's just a nice entry point into that conversation, because I have to have that with everybody that I talk to, whether they're an existing client or a potential client. We're having all these conversations. So I think just getting out in front of it is awesome. And I agree with everything that Cece said. And Cece, I think, also mentioned, you know, there's obviously a lot going on about things on Threads or any different social media platform about the beta reader that potentially did this. And so I just discovered, actually, I think Bianca sent this to me. I just discovered on Substack, there's this account called Lady Whistle Threads. And so if you're a Bridgerton fan, you know Lady Whistledown and how she kind of tells the gossip of the town. The Lady Whistle Threads every week has been summarizing what's happening on Threads in the writer community. And so, again, take it all with a grain of salt. I don't know how much she like links back to the original post. I don't know how accurate her summaries are. Again, I don't know this person at all. It is not me. But this is just a plug to Lady Whistle Threads, whoever you are. If you're wondering what the heck happens on Threads every week, then check out Lady Whistle Threads over on Substack.
I kind of love that that exists. Again, I heard about it in the same, Bianca sent the message, in our chat. So like I heard about it when you did too, but I kind of love that this exists, because I'll be honest, I do not have the patience to keep up with all the Threads drama. Like I'm just not going to spend, like my mental capacity is, I'm a human, right? Like my cognitive capacity is limited and this is just not where I want to spend my energy. So if it is an accurate summary, let's hope it is. It's a nice way to stay updated without having to like, it feels like every hour. It used to be like every day. Now it's like every hour. Like, oh my God, what did this person do or that person do? And the internet can be such a mean and scary place.
I can't keep up with it. And not to say that, you know, it comes back to the whole power imbalance thing, but not to say that agents always have the answers, and not all agents are quote unquote, you know, agents of authority on certain subject matters. But I find that the authority figures on different platforms are not getting top billing, as opposed to the more inflammatory things that are happening on there. And so I just don't think writers are getting a lot of answers on Threads. I think they're getting a lot more inflammatory content. So anyway, once again, not new news. Everybody knows this, but that's my two cents. All right, everybody. Well, we are at the end of our recording time. So thanks for hanging out with us. We hope you enjoyed the links that we have in the show notes. And we look forward to hanging out with you next time.
Cece Lira is a literary agent at Wendy Sherman Associates. If you'd like to query Cece, please refer to the submission guidelines at www.wsherman.com. Carly Waters is a literary agent at PS Literary Agency, but her work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly on this podcast are solely that of her as a podcast co-host and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. Have you been sitting on the fence about signing up for the Beta Reader matchup, or have you signed up before but haven't yet found your writing soulmates? The next matchup is the last one for the summer, so don't snooze on it. Get matched up with those writing in a similar genre and or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs. Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 1st of June, with the matchup emails going out on the 2nd of June. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and go to the Beta Reader matchup page.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. So I recently grabbed lunch with an acquiring editor from HarperCollins who told me that the number of submissions she's been getting has nearly doubled. And I wasn't surprised at all, because every agent and editor I know has been talking about how the volume of submission keeps increasing. So personally, that is a wonderful thing, because it's more reading for me, but it also means I have more chances of matching with authors. I consider it a privilege to review queries on Books with Hooks, and of course, in my submissions inbox. But at the same time, I talk to writers who tell me that they wish agents would read more than a few pages because, and I quote, "my story gets better in chapter 2." I have to be honest, this kills me. It's like me wanting chocolate chip cookies to have the nutritional value of kale. It's just not realistic. Like it or not, no agent, no acquiring editor is going to stick around to see if a submission gets better. It's not because we're mean, it's because we get dozens and dozens every day. I know it's harsh, but ambitious writers embrace harsh realities. So here it goes. It's your job to make your opening pages irresistible, to make agents crave it, to make agents want to read more. That's why I'm so excited about my upcoming course, Starting It Right: How to Begin Your Story in the Best Place and in the Best Way. I created this course after studying hundreds of books. I've mapped out elements that are present in the beginning of all successful novels and memoirs. And I've designed checklists, actual checklists, that you can use to ensure that your story's beginning is seducing your reader. We'll cover how to write a great first line, different types of beginnings and how you can choose the best one, the best place to start and the best way to start. Yes, these are totally different things. When it makes sense to add a prologue and when it doesn't, how to frame your inciting incident in an appealing way, how to balance exposition and mystery, how to include context but not weigh it down with too much backstory, and what to do if your story has more than one POV or timeline. Most of all, I'm going to show you how to make readers want to turn to chapter 2. Join me for this multi-day course designed to help you break through the noise. You'll leave with a clear, actionable breakdown of exactly what goes into a terrific beginning. If you've already signed up, come prepared to take lots of notes. We're talking hundreds of slides with real-world examples and specific techniques, plus a super fun surprise that I can't wait to share. I hope to see you there.